Shalom, welcome to ASJTF, the program in which we attempt to answer questions from our great JTFers. I'm Chaim Ben Pesach from the Jewish Task Force. This program is dedicated to a refuah shlema, complete recovery, for Sharon Mitman, Elsie Friedland, Shlomo Ben Sara, and Dorit Bat Sara, and to Ilui Neshamot, elevating of the souls, for Malka Bat Meir, Allegra Bat Shlomo, Elizabeth Friedland, Erwin Friedland, Myron Friedland, Daniel Nankin, Victor Hasdai, Pesach Zeb Ben Dov, Lunita Adler, Shifra Hoffman, Ruven Hoffman, Barry Hoffman, Harab Meir Kahana, Harab Binyamin Kahana, Tzipora Fegi Bat Liba, Yosef Ben Meir, Robert Mitman, Dennis Shore, Helen Friedman, and Charles Zolat. One of the things that is often said to supporters of our beloved Rabbi Meir Kahana, a blessed memory, to the true Kahanists, one of the things that people often say to us is, you mean you're right and everybody else is wrong? You know and everybody else doesn't know. You're right and everybody else is wrong. And you know, that's such an un-Jewish thing to say and such an un-Jewish way of thinking. First of all, yes, it is possible that only a small group of people can be right and almost everybody else can be wrong. We've seen that many times in history. We saw that during the Holocaust. How many Jews agreed with Vladimir Jabotinsky when he warned that there was going to be a Holocaust, when he warned that millions of Jews were going to be murdered in Europe? In the 20th century, they're going to murder millions of Jews? What are you, crazy? Even the children? Even the children they're going to murder? What are you, crazy? The ridicule that he faced for predicting that there would be a Holocaust against the Jews of Europe. And of course, almost everybody thought that he was wrong, and we saw what happened historically. He turned out to be right, and almost everybody else was wrong. And it's that way in many other cases in modern history. We're going to give you another example later in the program involving Rabbi Kahana. But first, the whole premise of the Jewish religion is that we have to stand up for the truth even when no one else accepts it. The very first Jew in the world was Avraham Avinu, Abraham our father. Avraham Avinu was called Avraham HaIvri, Abraham the Hebrew, Avraham HaIvri in Hebrew. And Chazal teach us that the word Ivri comes from the word Ever in Hebrew. Ever means side. And the rabbis, Chazal, the rabbinic sages in the Talmud tell us, because Avraham stood on one side and the whole world stood on the other side. Avraham said there's only one God and that Judaism wasn't Judaism yet, but what would eventually become Judaism and the laws of that one God, that's the true religion. And the whole world believed in idolatry. So the whole premise of where Judaism started out is based upon the fact that we're not afraid to go against the tide, to sail against the wind, and to say something that the whole world may disagree with. We're not afraid to say that when the truth demands that we say that. That's the whole premise of how Judaism as a religion started, with Avraham Avinu, with Yitzhak, Yaakov, our other father, the other fathers of the Jewish religion. And you know, how could you be Jewish and say, you mean you're right and everybody else is wrong? How could Jews say such a thing like that if they believe in Judaism? If they believe in Judaism. Unfortunately, most Jews today don't. But if they believe in what the Jewish religion really stands for, how could they possibly say something like that? Isn't it obvious that they're part of a religion that is a small minority? There are so few Jews in the world compared to the huge number of 1.5 billion Christians. Maybe close to 1.5 billion Muslims. 1 billion Hindus. What are the Jews? The Jews at most are maybe 13 million. I don't even think they are, but 13 million Jews maybe in the world. So if you believe that numbers and the majority is what decides what's right and wrong in the world, If you think that's how you base your decisions on what's right and wrong, you shouldn't be a Jew. You should be either a Christian or a Hindu or a Muslim, because they are the overwhelming majority. They have billions and we only have millions. And you know, all nations of the world are against the Jews, and always were against the Jews, having control in the land of Israel and returning to their homeland. Does that mean the nations of the world are right? Until recent history, every single country in the world refused to put their embassy in Jerusalem and didn't recognize Israeli control over Jerusalem. And by the way, even though Donald Trump did move the embassy to Jerusalem, he still, in his so-called peace plan, calls for Israel to give up parts of Jerusalem in order to create a capital for a so-called independent Palestinian state. So control over united Jerusalem, which is something that the vast majority of Israeli Jews support, control over united Jerusalem is something that all the nations of the world are against. You mean the Jews are right and everybody else is wrong? During the Black Plague, the bubonic plague in Europe, in which one-third to half of Europe's population died in the bubonic plague. It was unbelievable. We don't know exactly how many, but at least a third of the European population died in that plague. And the Jews died in much smaller numbers. Very few Jews got sick, and the Christians in Europe, there were Jews and Christians, there were only two groups at that time, the Jews and the Christians. And the Christians in country after country were dying in huge numbers, and the Jews, they were also dying, but much, much smaller numbers. Much smaller numbers. And so they blamed the Jews. They said that the Jews, that the rabbis were poisoning the wells and poisoning the water, and that was what was causing the plague. They blamed the Jews. The real reason, of course, was because the Jews had laws that require good sanitation. They washed their hands, they cleaned themselves, they kept clean, they went to the mikvah, they did other things. They had cleanliness and laws of cleanliness and sanitation. Whereas the Christian nations of Europe at the time didn't have laws like that. They didn't believe germs exist. They didn't know that germs hadn't been discovered yet. They didn't even know there was something called germs. And so they didn't wash their hands and they didn't clean themselves before eating and they didn't observe basic hygienic and sanitary requirements, and so they were dying in huge numbers and the Jews survived. But they blamed the Jews. They said it was a Jewish plot. And everybody in Europe believed it. You mean all the people in Europe are wrong when they say there was a Jewish plot? And only the Jews are right when they said, no, we're not doing this. This is not our fault that there's a plague. Jews are supposed to be rebels. Not be afraid to be against the majority when necessary. Jews are supposed to be rebels against evil and immorality and injustice. Jews are supposed to stand up for what's right, even if it is unpopular. And of course, only weak people, weak-minded people, have to turn to others and say, well, what does the majority think? What if the majority's again? Then they have to take a poll to decide where they stand on an issue. They have to see where the majority are. They're afraid to stand alone. They're afraid to stand among the few. Even though history shows that generally speaking on the biggest questions of the day, the majority are usually wrong. And only a small minority turn out to be right, historically, on the biggest questions of the day. And we had the ultimate example with Rabbi Meir Kahana, Zecher Tzaddik V'Kadosh Livracha Hashem Yikom Damo, which means, may the memory of this saint live on, and may his blood be avenged. When Rabbi Kahana was in the Knesset, in the Israeli parliament, he made a prediction that was universally ridiculed. Everybody was laughing at him when he said it. He said, if you don't pick Rabbi Kahana, in other words, if you don't pick the solution of Rabbi Kahana to move the Arabs out of Israel, if you don't take care of this Arab problem, if you don't take Kahana instead of Kahana, you're going to get Arafat. You're eventually going to deal with Arafat, you're going to bring him into the land of Israel, and you're going to wind up getting Arafat in the land of Israel. And it's going to bring terror and murder and bloodshed and tragedy to Israel and a threat to Israel's very existence. That was his prediction. That was in the 1980s when he was in the Knesset. Everybody ridiculed him because at that time Arafat was, even by the left, was almost universally compared to Hitler. Because Arafat spoke like Hitler. Arafat said, we're going to push the Jews into the sea, we're going to finish Hitler's job. These are the type of speeches Arafat used to make. And so the suggestion that Israel is going to deal with Arafat and bring him into the land of Israel and give parts of Israel to Arafat, the suggestion that Rabbi Kahana was making seems so far, so divorced from reality. People thought Rabbi Kahana had gone crazy when he said this. Even his own supporters didn't believe it and were concerned that he was making statements like this. And so when Arafat ultimately, and you know what it's like, it would be like somebody saying in the United States, you know, Al-Qaeda, you're going to make a deal with Al-Qaeda and they're going to come in and they're going to take away parts of the United States. You're going to give parts of America over to the terrorists of Al-Qaeda who carried out the 9/11 attacks. Or you're going to give to the Islamic State, to ISIS, you're going to give states in the U.S. and parts of the U.S. over to ISIS, and you're going to invite them to the White House and bring them to the White House and start negotiating with ISIS at the White House. Someone predicted that, most people would say, come on, that's not going to happen. Not ISIS. But that was what it was like when Rabbi Kahana said that Arafat was a venture that Israel was going to deal with Arafat and was going to accept Arafat and legitimize him and bring him in and give land to him. When Rabbi Kahana made that prediction, everybody thought it was absurd what he was saying. And one of the leaders of the phony right, Arik Sharon, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, Shem Reshaim Yerkav, who at that time was considered to be extreme right-winger, everybody said. Only Rabbi Kahana, by the way, on Sharon. Rabbi Kahana was the only one who said that Sharon is a fraud and that if Sharon ever gets power, he'll destroy Jewish settlements and expel Jews like no one else ever did. Rabbi Kahana made that prediction as well, which nobody else believed. But anyway, Sharon at the time, when in terms of the Arafat prediction of Rabbi Kahana, he ridiculed Rabbi Kahana. And Sharon said, and Sharon at the time said, the left in Israel, as much as we're against the left and as much as we don't agree with the left in Israel is not going to accept Arafat. And Rabbi Kahana responded by saying, I'm not speaking only about the left. I'm speaking about the Likud and the phony right as well. They're also going to accept Arafat. Oh, that caused so much ridicule. The Likud is going to accept Arafat? The ridicule that he faced. The laughter. Rabbi Kahana never backed down, even though what he said seemed so out of place, so out of whack with reality to the overwhelming majority of Israeli Jews, but he never backed down. He kept telling the truth. In 1990, our great beloved rabbi was murdered by Al-Qaeda. The first terrorist act of the Al-Qaeda Islamic murderers. And 3 years later, in 1993, with the Oslo agreements, the Arab Hitler Yasser Arafat was invited into Israel, together with tens of thousands of armed Arab Islamic Nazi terrorists who had the blood of thousands of Jews dripping from their hands. All of them were invited into Israel and given land, and preparations are made to give them a state. And it wasn't only done by the left, not only by Rabin and Peres. Bibi Netanyahu met with Arafat, hugged him, said, I found a new friend, a true friend and a new friend, Bibi said. Bibi Netanyahu from the phony right Likud party. And he continued the Oslo agreements under what were called the Y agreements, where he gave Arafat another 13% of Judea and Samaria and surrendered 97% of Hebron, the city of our forefathers, where our forefathers are buried, in Meirat HaMachpelah, in the cave of the patriarchs, the second holiest city in the world, Hebron. He handed over 90% of Hebron to Arafat and to the Islamic Nazi terrorists. Everything Rabbi Kahana said about that came true. And all the other people, now you would think all the other people would at least be intellectually honest enough to say, you know something? I at the time said Rabbi Kahana was crazy and I laughed at him, I ridiculed him. I was wrong and he was right. You think any of them admitted that? Geula Cohen, Arik Sharon, all these phony, fraudulent, lying vermin who claim to be right wing. They never admitted they were wrong. And so in the end, history becomes the judge in the end. You see, when you say, you mean you're right and everyone else is wrong? When somebody says that to you, just remember, that's been said to many, many people who were right throughout history, by people who were wrong throughout history. Been said many, many times. And yes, history has proven that the true Kahanists were right, and Rabbi Kahana was right. And today, the hilltop youth are right. The hilltop youth who say we must save the land of Israel from a so-called Palestinian state, which would be national suicide, which would be endangering Israel's very existence, the hilltop youth are right. And so we've got to support them because they are the true fighters for justice and truth and honesty and righteousness in our generation. And if we don't stand up for them, we're really putting ourselves in a terrible situation. There are two ways that you can support the heroic hilltop youth, and that you can show that you support those who are not a bunch of phony politicians and opportunists, who are not trying to ingratiate themselves with the Likud, a party which calls itself right-wing, but which has surrendered more Jewish land than any other party in Israel's history. Far more. No. You're supporting the real right, and the Jews who really are not willing to give up our historic rights in Israel. And the only Jews who are standing up for what Jews are supposed to stand up for in their homeland. Here's how you support the Hilltop Youth. You can go to our main page, our main Hebrew page, which is hayamin.org, and you click on the donate button in English on top. There's a big donate button in English on top. Most of the page is in Hebrew, but on top you'll see a donate button in English. And if you click on it, in several minutes you can very easily and conveniently make a donation to help the heroic Hilltop Youth. And that's if you want to do it online. Now, if you want to do it through regular mail, you can send checks and money orders through the regular mail, checks made out to JTF, and you send it to JTF P.O. Box 650327, Fresh Meadows, New York, 11365. JTF P.O. Box 650327, Fresh Meadows, New York, 11365. We're supposed to be a people that stand up for righteousness and justice and truth, even when it's unpopular. That's what we're supposed to do. That's what God wants us to do. And that's true for the Jews, and yes, it's also true for the righteous Gentiles. All right, let's go now to our questions from our great JTFers. If I can get to it, of course. All right. And here we go, and the first question is from our good friend Joe Gutfeld, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, you always talk about the Hilltop Youth. How did they become an organization? Thanks, unquote. The Hilltop Youth were Jews 25 years ago, really started. Young Jews who realized that the accepted settlements in Judea and Samaria, as important as they are, were not enough to keep Judea and Samaria and to prevent the so-called Palestinian state. Of course, there is no Palestine, there are no Palestinians. But in order to prevent a terrorist state like that from coming into being, that the Jews had to go out and start taking land, because the Arabs were taking our land. They had to go out and do that, and the Hilltop Youth understood that. That's how the idea came into being. And now you have, of course, dozens of hilltops on the most strategic high points of Judea and Samaria, who are performing an essential security function for the Jewish people. So that's what we're trying to support. That's what we in JTF are doing everything we can to support, because it's the most essential thing you can do for Israel right now. Thank you, Joe. And now we go to our other good friend, Hirvatsky Noachide, who always asks great questions, and this week he asks, and I quote, one, Maimonides identified Abraham's 10 tests in Perush HaMishnayot LeRambam. Can you name them? You know, I am so tired right now. I'm really exhausted because of the hilltops, because of what we're doing with the hilltops. I only slept 3 hours last night, and the night before I only slept 5 or 6 hours. I don't remember if it was 5 hours or 6 hours. I need 8 hours of sleep. I'm 65 years old. I need 8 hours of sleep a night. And, you know, we had a really very, very challenging 48 hours here because of problems on the hilltops, things that we had to deal with. So I'm not going to do it from... I might be able to do it from memory, but I don't want to chance it to memory, Hirvatsky. So let me go looking on the internet. I will try to find it. Let me write this in. Let me see here. Let me go looking on the internet. Let me see here. Let's see. I have a yeshiva page opened here. Let me see if the yeshiva page has... Yes, I see it here. Okay. Here are the 10 tests that Avraham went through. He went through 10 tests that God put him through. They're called Nisyonot in Hebrew. And this is according to... who is this according to? This is HaMishnah B'Masechet Avot. Okay. It says there were 10 tests. And HaRambam. This is from HaRambam. These are the 10 tests according to HaRambam. Because, Hirvatsky, there is a machloket. There's a disagreement between HaRambam and others as to what exactly the... Generally, there's agreement, I think, on almost all the tests, but here and there, there's disagreements about what all the 10 tests were. This is according to HaRambam, what the 10 tests were. The first was Lech Lecha Me'artzecha, which Hashem told Abraham, leave your land for another land that I'm going to show you. That was a big test. Abraham was 75 years old, and he was told he has to leave his land where he had thousands of followers, where he was teaching people about one God and monotheism. And God is telling him, no, you pick up and go away. You pick up and take off. I want you to go to a different land, which was going to be the land of Israel, but Hashem didn't tell him yet what land it was going to be. That was a big test. Just pick up and leave everything, behind, just go to this other land. I'm not even telling you where. And, of course, Abraham passed that test. That was the first test. The second test... When he gets to the land of Israel, there's starvation in the land, and he's forced to go to Egypt. He's forced to leave the land of Israel and go to Egypt. So, I mean, that's quite... Hashem tells you to go to a land, takes you, picks you up, makes you leave your home, leave everything that you did, your life's work, thousands of followers, you have to leave all of them and go to this land. And then when you get to the land, there's starvation, and you have to leave and go to Egypt because you're starving. Another big test. That was the second big test. Third big test. His wife Sarah, Abraham's wife Sarah, was taken to the house of Paro, of Pharaoh, because the border guards, when they wanted to go into Egypt, saw how beautiful Sarah was, and so they said, "Oh, this is she's perfect for Paro. She's good for Pharaoh. He would want a beautiful woman like this." So they took her away from him, and brought Sarat to Pharaoh. So that was a big test. He was worried that Pharaoh was going to, you know, was going to take his wife, and he did take her briefly into the palace. He didn't do anything to her, but it was a big test to have your wife taken away and taken over. Pharaoh, the biggest king and the most powerful king in the world, quite a test. That was number three. The fourth test, he goes to war against four kings because they kidnap Lot and Lot's relatives. And so he goes to war against four kings in order to save his nephew Lot and Lot's family. So you're going to war against four kingdoms, and you just have a group of several dozen followers at that time. And eventually, I mean, he put together other people to support him as well, but he started out with just several dozen people to go to war against four kingdoms in order to free his nephew and his nephew's family. That was the fourth test. The fifth test, he had to take Hagar, the Egyptian who was the daughter of Pharaoh, he had to take Hagar as his wife because Sarah could not conceive a child. Hashem promised him that he's going to have a child that's going to continue, that's going to have this legacy, and it's going to be in the land of Israel, and they're going to and had a brit with him, a covenant with him, and promised him, and then his wife, and then after promising he's going to have a child, his wife couldn't conceive. It's a big test, so he had to take Hagar the Egyptian as his wife in order to have a child, and Hagar eventually had Yishmael. That was her son with Abraham. But Yishmael was not the chosen one in the end. You know, Hashem promised that it was going to be with Sarah. But Sarah told Abraham, no, you can't have a child with me, at least have a child, at least have some family here. You know, so they agreed, Sarah and Abraham agreed that he would take, as a second wife, would take Hagar, the Egyptian. That was the fifth test. And the sixth test, he had to get circumcised as an old man. He was very old already, and he had to get circumcised. Circumcision, in those days, they didn't have anesthesia. The rabbis teach us that they used to get drunk. That was their anesthesia. For an adult to get circumcised is very, very painful without anesthesia. And he had to do it as an adult, and did do it. That was the sixth test. The seventh test, Sarah was taken then to the house of Avimelech. Avimelech was the king of the Plishtim, of the Philistines. So again, his wife is taken from him, and he faces the danger of his wife being sexually attacked and abused by this idol-worshipping king. Was another big test. That was the seventh test. The eighth test, he then, after marrying Hagar, and after marrying her, and she was his second wife, he had to throw her out. He had to remove her because of the way she was arrogantly speaking towards Sarah. Sarah demanded that she be removed, and he had to do that. And that wasn't easy to do because, you know, it's his wife. He has to throw her out and tell her to go, you know, just go and give her supplies and say get out. It's not an easy test. That was the eighth test. And the ninth test was that he had then, when Yishmael was born with Hagar. Yishmael eventually would be the father of the Muslims and the Arabs. When Yishmael was born with Hagar, and Yishmael was Abraham's son. Abraham had to throw his own son out. And at that time, he had to throw his own son out of the house. That's not easy. You raise a son who's born, someone's born who's your son, and you raise him, and you grow up with him, and you throw him out of the house. It's a very hard thing to do. That was his ninth test. And the tenth test was the toughest of them all. That was the test where he had to sacrifice the real son that was going to take over and become the son of Sarah, because Sarah eventually did conceive when she was 90 years old. She conceived. It was a miracle. And Abraham was 99. And when that happened, he raised Yitzchak. Yitzchak was going to be the son who was going to continue. Yitzchak being Isaac in English. Yitzchak was going to continue the legacy. And then And then all of a sudden Hashem says to him, God says to him, no, you've got to sacrifice him. After all these years of him preaching against human sacrifice, after all these years of being against this barbaric practice, after all these years of saying we can never do this, and after Hashem promised Abraham that Yitzchak was going to be the son who was going to continue the eternal lineage and create a Jewish people that would be a light unto the nations and a holy nation, nation of priests, now he's saying kill him. What a test that was. Abraham passed that test too. That was the 10th and final test according to Harambam. So that's according to Harambam, those are the tests. Now let me try to get back to where we were here. Where was I? Okay. And now Hirovatsky writes a second question. Do today's Jews have greater tests than Abraham? No, of course not. Of course not. Today's Jews couldn't pass. Most Jews today couldn't pass any test. Of course not. Abraham had the most painful and difficult tests because he was a giant. And I don't mean physically a giant. I mean, he might have been also physically tall as well, but I mean he was a giant in terms of his heroic ability to acclimate himself to whatever God demanded of him, and his unswerving loyalty and faith in the God of Israel and the God of the universe. So of course Abraham's tests were much greater. Thank you very much, Hirovatsky. And we go now to Binyamin Yisrael, our other good friend, who writes, discuss the following Egyptian heads of state since Egyptian independence. King Fuad, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, 1922 to 1936. He was a corrupt king, like all Egyptian leaders, just a corrupt, evil king, robbing his people of everything and being cruel and impossible. And the Jews of Egypt, including my family who lived in Egypt at the time, you know, the Jews of Egypt had to suffer under his rule. And that was in the 1920s. And the next one is King Farouk, who succeeded him. King Farouk, same story. Another evil king. King Farouk was also the king who ordered the Egyptian army in 1948 to invade the newly created state of Israel and exterminate all the Jewish people there, and also was pogroms and attacks and persecution of Jews in Egypt accelerated under King Farouk. So he was another very evil Jew-hating, Jew-killing monster. And then we have Mohammed Najib, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, who was one of what was called the Officers' Rebellion. They overthrew King Farouk in 1952, Egyptian army officers, and he was the head of the rebellion. And he, for 2 years, became the dictator of Egypt until he was eventually gotten rid of and overthrown by the next one on your list, Gamal Abdul Nasser, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro. Nasser was from 1954 to 1970, 16 years, and he was the one that led Egypt into the 1956 Sinai War, where Israel captured all of Sinai in 4 days, and then surrendered it all, gave it all away under David Ben-Gurion, under Bozo. And then you had the 1967 Six-Day War under Nasser, which was the ultimate Arab catastrophe, where the whole Arab world went against Israel, and Israel beat the living daylights out of them, outnumbered 100-1, and beat the living daylights out of the whole Arab world in just 6 days, and quadrupled in size in just 6 days. The only problem is, of course, the Jews couldn't wait to spoil the miracle and give away most of the land that they won, which they did. They gave away all of Sinai, they've given away large parts of Judea and Samaria, they gave away all of Gaza, they gave away part of the Golan Heights, and now if the Hilltop Youth don't win, God forbid, we could create a Palestinian state where they're going to give away all of it, and including Jerusalem, and we're going to wind up in suicidal borders, God forbid, if we don't back the Hilltop Youth. But anyway, that was under Nasser. And then in 1970, Nasser died of a heart attack, and Anwar el-Sadat, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro, became president, and he was president for 11 years. He was the most dangerous of all the Arab leaders we ever faced. The most dangerous was Anwar el-Sadat. He was a very clever Nazi snake. He was a fervent supporter of Adolf Hitler. He was put in British prison for 4 years for collaborating with and trying to help the Germans win World War II. He was working to help the Germans capture Egypt and win World War II, and he was put in British prison for 4 years because of his Nazi activities and his support for the Nazis during the war. And all his life he was a lover of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, and just like Hitler, he pretended he was going to give Israel peace in our time. And through that lie, he got all of Sinai. Menachem Begin and the Likud gave him all of Sinai, which was a catastrophe. And Sadat was assassinated in 1981, and then we had Hosni Mubarak, Yimach Shmo v'Zichro, who was president for 20 years until 2011. And Hosni Mubarak was another corrupt, evil dictator. But Mubarak didn't want to lose the Sinai again and didn't want to lose more land, so he decided he's going to let Israel, he's not going to go to war with Israel, he's going to try to destroy Israel gradually by pressuring Israel diplomatically to surrender land, which he participated in, and by using the Sinai to flood Israel with hundreds of thousands of illegal aliens from Africa and from the Third World, came through the Sinai into Israel, and today they're more than 70% of the population of South Tel Aviv, for instance. Catastrophe. Hosni Mubarak is the one who started that policy, using Sinai. And then he was overthrown and in what was called the Arab Spring, and then you had Mohamed Morsi, Yimach Shmo v'Zichro, who was the head of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and he became the dictator of Egypt, but he only lasted, I think, about a year as prime minister, or as president. I think he was president. I don't know if it's president. Yeah, president. He was the president. They call it president. It's a dictator, a vicious, murderous dictator. He was overthrown after a year. Muhammad, the Muslim Brotherhood, of course, fanatic Muslim Nazi terrorists. And then he was replaced by Abdel Fattah El Sisi, Yimach Shmo v'Zichro, who replaced him 8 years ago, something like that, and has been the dictator ever since. And El Sisi is a very dangerous and clever Arab snake who has continued the policy of trying to get illegal aliens to flood into Israel through the Sinai, who continues to pressure Israel with diplomatic moves, constantly pressuring Israel to create a Palestinian state, who worked hard to get the Trump so-called peace plan approved, which would have been suicide for Israel. So he continues in the Sadat tradition of being a clever Arab, which is, of course, much more dangerous. The more clever the Arabs are, the more they say, oh, I want peace. Just give us the land and just give us Judea and Samaria and Jerusalem and then you'll have peace. Those are the most dangerous Arabs. You don't want a clever enemy. You don't want an enemy who lies to you and says one thing in English and in Hebrew and then another thing in Arabic. That you don't want, because Jews are so stupid and so anxious to crawl on their hands and knees and believe peace, peace, peace at any price. That when you have an Arab leader like that, it's very dangerous. So he's bad news, LCC. Thank you, Binyamin. And now we go to our friend Yimach Shmo to Islam, who writes, and I quote, Der Chaim. Why do black majority cities have higher than average crime rates? Take places like Baltimore, Newark, Memphis, and Birmingham, for example. These cities are a nightmare, unquote. Yes, that's true, and that's because black culture is a violent, murderous, raping, evil, blood-sucking culture where they go on welfare and they live in housing projects and they take food stamps and take all these other programs. Then they get jobs that they get a job and they don't do anything on the job. They're completely incompetent. They're the first hired and the last fired, even though they have IQs in the single digits, and even though they have brains the size of a peanut. And, you know, and I'm not talking about, I'm talking about all blacks. Of course there are exceptions. There are blacks who are not like that. And if blacks are not Jew haters and not against the Jewish people, you know, we have a completely different, we have nothing against them. We have no problem with them. But the problem is the vast majority of blacks do support Farrakhan and do support Jesse Jackson, Barack Hussein, Osama, and all these other black Jew-hating leaders. And so they're enemies of the Jewish people. And so they deserve all the attacks that we give them and then some. And of course, if they become a majority in the city, it's a nightmare. Of course it's a nightmare. Because these are cruel people who are cruel to their own, they abandon their own children. Black fathers, over 80% of black children are illegitimate. They abandon their own children. They don't even love their own kids. And beat their women and brutalize their own people. I mean, just horrible. So of course, in the cities where they are, you're going to see very high crime rates and gang activity and all the other atrocities that we see when blacks take over. That's just the reality. Thank you very much, Yimach Shmo to Islam. And by the way, I don't care about the color of their skin. I don't judge them by the color of their skin. I judge them by the content of their character. And their character is a character of being jealous, lazy, evil, hateful, anti-Semitic swine. That's the character. There are blacks who are not like that. There are exceptions. The blacks who are not like that, I have nothing against them. But the blacks who are like that, if they're enemies of my people, they're my enemy. And now we go to Roi, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, why don't you grow a beard on Passover? As far as I know, this is a mitzvah that must be performed on the holiday, and why don't you grow the rest of the time? Thanks. Well, it's not a mitzvah. It's a minhag. Minhag is a custom. Mitzvah is a commandment. It is not a commandment to grow a beard. It is a minhag. There are Jews who follow the minhag. And of course, I respect them, and it's a very nice minhag. But it's not a commandment; it's not a mitzvah. Thank you very much, Roi. And we go now to Ram Sheva Sheva Efes, who writes in Hebrew, and I'm going to quickly translate. Shalom Chaim, Hayakar, Mashlomcha. מתרגש היום שיש לך את הרעיון עם אלכס שסידרתי לך אישית וגם מה דעתך על שהייתי בחומש. And Ram writes here that he arranged an interview with me with Alex, who is someone who does interviews in Hebrew on the internet. I did do the interview before doing this program. And I think it was a very good interview in Hebrew, and yes, that Ram is the one who arranged it. Ram, ata asita et ze, ani mekave she Alex yale et ha-reayon she asiti ito hayom bekarov, ani mekave she hu yale et ze la-atar shelo, o la-arut shelo ב-YouTube, ata hu she asa et ze. Ze nachon. Kol ha-kavod, Ram. Kol ha-kavod, yishar koach. And Ram writes now, and I quote, אני חושב צריכים לקבוע תאריך לארגן שיחת זום נוספת, מה דעתך אישית גם, אני, אישית גם, אני בעד לקשר אותך לחברי הכנסת שמחה רוטמן ומיכל ולדיגר מהציונות הדתית, לגבי הסירוב העלייה שלך, הם מוכנים לעזור לך, לעלות אותך ארצה, אשמח שנדבר שוב בפרטי, ושהקדוש ברוך הוא יברך אותך באהבת ישראל, רם מאיר אברהם. And he says basically here that, you know, that he wants to put me in touch with members of the Knesset, because of my Aliyah situation. Unfortunately, those members of the Knesset don't have the power to get me into Israel. But he wants to do another Zoom, because he also did a Zoom with the people that he knows. We also did a Zoom in Hebrew in Israel, and he wants to do that again. I think that's a good idea. Eventually, we're going to do that. Ram bimrutzat hazman, ani mekave sheken naaseh od Zoom legabei chavrei haKnesset. Letzari ein lishnei chavrei haKnesset haele et hakoach להכניס אותי לארץ ישראל. רם, אני ביקשתי שמונה פעמים כבר, אם אני אבקש כל שנה, כי ביקשתי רק גם בשנה שעברה, אם אני אבקש כל שנה, אני לא בטוח שזה יעיל. אבל אנחנו נדבר על זה. Ani modeh lecha, Ram. And now we go to our good friend Chabad Kahanist, who writes, and I quote, "Do you think that Meretz is the Pantsies party, being that wherever you see a rainbow flag, you also see a Meretz election poster during elections, and being that the head of Meretz, Nitzan Homowitz, is a flaming faggot?" Thank you for being politically correct, Chabad Kahanist. No. Every word that you write is true, and I agree with every word. His name, by the way, he's referring to someone named Nitzan Horowitz, but he's calling him Homowitz, who is an open homosexual, and he's the head of the Meretz party. Meretz is an extreme left party that wants to destroy Israel. No question about it that it's a party associated with homosexuals and with deviants and perverts, sodomites. And of course, the head of the party is a sodomite and a deviant, a pervert. But I want to remind you, Chabad Kahanist, that that's not limited just to the left. The phony right is just as bad on that issue. Amir Ohana, Chabad Kahanist, was the Minister of Justice, right? Sar HaMishpatim. And he was also the Minister of Public Security. He was a cabinet minister, two different cabinet, big, important cabinet positions. Amir Ohana. And he's a big Likud leader who scores very high on the top. Some people even say he may, God forbid, even be prime minister someday. He is an open homosexual who lives with another man. Openly. And is very proud of it. And defends the whole sodomite agenda. That's the Likud, Chabad Kahanist. Not Meretz. The Likud does that. So we got a real problem here. We got a real problem that Jews with Jewish values are not being represented. The people being represented are people who are against Jewish values. Thank you, Chabad Kahanist. And now we go to our other friend, Chicago Jew, who writes, and I quote, "Your opinion of the correct decision made by federal judge Catherine Kimball Mizell sticking down," or you, I think you meant to say striking down, "federal mask mandate. Of course, you will disagree with her and I." I think masks work. I do disagree. I think masks work. So I don't think that's too much of a price to pay in order to save people's lives. Do you know that a majority of Americans have been infected with the coronavirus at some point? Majority of Americans have some of them. Are asymptomatic. They don't have any symptoms, but a majority of Americans have been infected. This is a massive disease that has caused tremendous tragedy for America and for the world. And I don't think wearing masks and doing the other things that we could have done to stop this is too much to ask. But anyway, we disagree on this one. Chicago Jew, you yourself wrote that on the vast majority of issues we agree, and that is true. We do. We agree on most things, but on this particular issue, we disagree. Thank you, Chicago Jew. And now we go to Chaim Azulai Efeshesh, who's going to write to us in Hebrew again, and I'm going to read it and quickly translate. Shalom Rav, Chaim Hayakar VeHanichbad, Ratziti Lishol Kama Devarim. Lefi Ma Shehevanti, Yesh Lecha Mishpacha Ba'aretz, Hevanti Shehem Chaim Be'afula. Ma לגביהם, הם ניסו לעזור לפנות למשרד הפנים בעניינך? מה הסטטוס בפעם האחרונה שפנו לשם במידה שפנו? Okay, he's asking if my family in Israel, which lives in Afula, which is true, I do have family in Afula, if my relatives who live in Israel, if they have gone to the Interior Ministry on my behalf as far as my aliyah. First, I'll answer in Hebrew, then in English. Lo ani lo bikashti mikrovei hamishpacha sheli lifnot lemisrat hapnim ki ani lo rotze shehem ani lo rotze she tiena lahem bayot im havoda shelahem ani atem yodim she hashiltonot lo ohavim oti. ואם הם יודעים שהם קרובי המשפחה שלי, אני לא יודע, הם עלולים לתת להם צרות. אז אני לא ביקשתי מזה, אני לא ביקשתי מהם להתערב, ואני לא רוצה שהם יתערבו. הם יהודים טובים, המשפחה שלי בארץ, והם עוזרים. אני לא יכול לפרט איך, אבל הם עוזרים בצורה מסוימת ויעילה, ואני לא מבקש שהם יעשו יותר מזה. And I just said that my family is not going to intervene because I don't want them to have any problems with the effect that they find out that they're relatives of Chaim ben Pesach. I don't know if they're going to get harassed or, well, yeah, they might get harassed by the government or whatever. I don't want them to go through harassment and have problems. So, but they are good Jews. They are helping and doing things. And I'm not going to go into, and I said I'm not going to go into detail, but they are helping. And but I have not asked them to go to the Interior Ministry on my behalf and tell them that they're my relatives. Chaim now writes, and I quote, מה דעתך על הדרוזים? האם מבחינתך הם חלק חשוב ממדינת ישראל? לפי דעתי, עדיף אותם על פני כלל ערביי ישראל. אשמח לדעת גם את דעתך בנושא הזה. And he asks about the Druzim, about the Druze, which is a breakaway sect, by the way, from Islam. They're breakaways from Islam, and they're hated by many of the Muslims. But still, first let me answer him in Hebrew. Ani lo somech al hadruzim. Hadruzim ne'emanim lemi sheyesh lo koach. B'Suria, hem ha'chayalim ha'surim ha'ne'emanim biyoter. Oto davar b'Lebanon, hem ratzchu me'ot. מאות חיילי צהל נרצחו על ידי דרוזים, על ידי וליד ג'ומבלט והדרוזים בלבנון. אז אני לא סומך עליהם, הם לא נאמנים לאף אחד, ואני חושב שכדאי שהם יעזבו יחד עם הערבים האחרים. אם אנחנו יכולים לשכנע אותם תמורת פיצויים לעזוב, אני חושב שזה יהיה יותר טוב לכולנו. And I just told him that I don't trust the Druze because they're not loyal, and they're only loyal to whoever's in power and whoever's stronger in Syria. They're loyal Syrian soldiers. In Lebanon, they were murderous. They murdered hundreds of Israeli soldiers during the Lebanon War, the Druze. So, you know, I don't trust them. And I think that we should persuade them to leave with compensation the same way as the other Arabs. לפי עמיחי שיקלי, לגבי עמיחי שיקלי, האם אתה חושב שהוא יצליח בבחירות הבאות לקבל מספיק קולות על מנת לעבור את אחוז החסימה במידה ויכריז על ריצה עצמאית לכנסת, או שאתה מאמין שריצה עצמאית תבזבז קולות קריטיים לימין ושעדיף לו כרגע לקחת פסק זמן מהפוליטיקה? And here he's writing about someone who has said that he's going to run on a new party in Israel. His name is Amichai Shikli. What do I think of it? And is it going to split the right and take votes away from the right? אני בשבילי גם הוא ימין מזויף. כל המפלגות בימין כביכול בעיניי הם ימין מזויף. אז לא אכפת לי מה הוא יעשה. לא אכפת לי. אני לא חושב שזה משנה. אני לא חושב שהוא ירוץ עצמאית לגמרי. אני חושב שהוא אולי יודע שהוא מתכוון לרוץ, ואחר כך הוא יעשה עסקה יחד עם עוד רשימה כדי לרוץ יחד איתם. כי לבד אני לא חושב שהוא יכול לעבור את אחוז החסימה. And I told him I don't think he would pass the minimum threshold, so I think he'll probably announce and then make a deal with another party and run together with them. Toda rabba al hakol veshiye hemshech shavu atov. And he writes, thank you, and you should have a good week. Gam lecha, Chaim, gam lecha, toda rabba. And now we go to our good friend, Kahana Will Always Be Right, who writes, and I quote, comment on, and then there are names of five women here. And again, I don't look good when I have to do this because all five are bad in my eyes. So, no, actually, the first one I'm going to say something good about, but the other four out of the five are bad in my eyes. Okay, the first one is Ann Coulter. I respect her because she supported Trump enthusiastically in 2016, and when he betrayed his followers and didn't build that wall, she said, I demand that you build that wall and I demand you take action on immigration. When he didn't do it, when he broke his promise, she at least was honest enough to break ranks with him and say, I'm not supporting you anymore. Okay? And she lost tremendous, tremendous support she lost. Her books were the best-selling books. She was adored by people. She was on Fox television day and night. Because she's a very eloquent speaker. And she lost all of that when she turned on Trump, because Trump did not keep his word, and she wanted that wall built the way Trump promised. Remember, build that wall, and he didn't do it. He broke his word. She held him to that promise. She said during the campaign she wasn't. Everybody said. There's another example, like my opening the monologue we did on the show in the opening, of where you say, you mean you were only you're right and everybody else is wrong. We were the only ones who said Trump is not going to keep his promise, even in terms of the wall. And everybody thought we were crazy. That, at least he's going to do that. I mean, that's his number one campaign. At least that he's going to do. He didn't even build 5% of the wall. Complete fraud. But Ann Coulter was honest enough, and so I respect her for that. And next we go to Pamela Geller. Ugh. You know, just a Jewish woman who condemned JTF and said, I'll never have anything to do with JTF. You know, because somebody suggested that would she work with us, and then she, oh no, you know, she wouldn't work with anybody. You know, but a woman who's maybe 60 years old, you know, who runs around in bikinis, you know, almost naked in bikinis, and it's just disgusting, really. She's just. I mean, what can I say? I just don't have any respect for her. She makes me sick. Not just because of the bikini. Not particularly just because she wears bikinis. And in Judaism, I don't think women should be exposing themselves like that, and going practically naked. I don't think a Jewish woman should do that. I think it's a disgrace. But not just that. That's not the only issue, because she doesn't believe in Judaism. It's the fact that she has no principles and she's an opportunist and a phony. She is. And so I don't like sellouts, and she is a sellout. And the next one is Laura Ingraham. Oh, talk about sellouts. Oh, is she a fraud? Such a phony. Such a phony with her giant cross. You know, she converted to Catholicism. Why would you want to convert to Catholicism? What would you see as the reason to convert to a religion where the priests... where tens of thousands of priests have molested little boys? Why would you want to convert to a religion like that, and a religion which is so insane? I mean, just with the Pope and the Vatican and the Pope is the vicar of Christ on earth, and the crazy things they predicted would happen that never came true. Yeah, just why would you want to be part of that? But anyway, she's a complete phony. She'll do anything for ratings. She has a show on Fox News. She'll do anything for ratings. She's a phony. And next we have Michelle Malkin. Oh, the anti-Semite. Michelle Malkin is a Jew hater. Michelle Malkin is a Holocaust denier and a Jew hater. And you know, she associates with Nazis even though she's not white. She's not white. She's Asian. But she associates with Nazis who hate who hate people like her, but are using her. It's just amazing. And she's a Holocaust denier now, and she's become a vicious Jew hater and a Holocaust denier. She's scum. Scum! She should die of every cancer under the sun. She says, why shouldn't I be able to question the Holocaust? And why? And they're always going, she went into the attack on, I forgot what she called Zionists, attacking Zionists, which means... existence of Israel, and she goes to these Nazi conferences now. She should die of every cancer under the sun. And next we have Ivanka Trump, the daughter of Donnie. And Ivanka Trump is the you know, she did her phony conversion. She married that animal Kushner. Her and her animal husband Kushner went to push their so-called peace plan for Israeli suicide. I can't stand her. I absolutely can't stand her. Horrible. She presents herself as a religious Jewish woman who she's not religious, and her conversion is invalid. Thank you, Kahana will always be right. And now we go to Amraphael, another good guy who writes, and I quote, "How and why does the media cover up stories that can hurt the Democrats, like Anita Hill's accusations or Obama with Farrakhan, and promote stories that hurt Republicans, such as 47% pay no taxes and grab them by the expletive? What's the main reason American Jews are so adamant about the Democratic Party?" Okay. The media supports the Democrats. I mean, that's just the fact. The media is left-wing and they support the Democrats. I think they're stupid for being against the Republicans, because I think the Republicans are also left-wing in my eyes. But the media doesn't think so. And so the media does everything they can to promote the Democrats. They're biased. They're fraud. You see with Facebook and with YouTube and with Instagram and with Google, you see how they rig everything. And Twitter was rigged also against anyone who wasn't a leftist. With tremendous censorship. They just censor anybody who opens up their mouth, who says the most legitimate things. You're not allowed to say anything. You're automatically censored and shut down. And Twitter was like that. I hope that Elon Musk keeps his word and changes that and ends the censorship. If he does, we certainly want to go on Twitter, and we certainly want to promote ourselves on Twitter more aggressively. And we have a Twitter. We've had a Twitter English account. But we want to promote ourselves aggressively, especially in Hebrew, especially because if there really is no censorship there, a lot of Israelis are going to go there, because Israelis really get censored like crazy with the Nazis on Facebook, YouTube, Google, Instagram. All these other sites are all run by people who treat the Jews These are people who have Nazi policies toward Jews. They literally allow Nazis to come on and preach Nazism. They allow Arab terrorists to come on and call for Israel's destruction and violence and murder against Jews. They allow Holocaust deniers and other... That's all permitted. If a Jew just defends Israel mildly, he gets banned. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So let's hope that Twitter becomes a place where people can speak publicly, and that if Musk keeps his word and Twitter is a place where there isn't this type of censorship, that would be a very positive development for the Jewish people and for the world. Thank you very much, and I want to thank everybody for another JTF show that I very much enjoyed doing. If we just work together and fight together for what's right, we can make this a better world. We can change history. We can make this a place where it's better for us and for all future generations. For JTF, until next week, this is Chaim Ben Pesach. Shalom.